women that you should contact beside us.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is Ardith Tappan.
Right. We know about her.
You know her.
Yes.
And then Fern Placeway, you know about
her? Yeah.
We do?
I got her ad.
Oh. You do?
Yeah. It was on some information that Mr. Rankin gave us last week.
Oh,
she was
okay.
The nurse at the first aid.
Pardon?
Was she the nurse at the first aid?
Right.
Or
she was
the
head
hospital?
Of the hospital.
Yeah.
Or,
I really
agree. Ardith was.
Fern Placeway. I didn't know that.
Oh, Ardith was. I'm sorry. Fern Placeway was.
And personnel. Right.
Oh, okay.
I got her name and address and everything. It was on Mr. Rankin's papers.
Fern Placeway is the one that wrote this synopsis.
Oh, I see.
I'm almost sure she was.
Okay. We just found out that the women all meet. I'm sorry, I have a bad call.
I do too. I've had it for 2 days now. My wife's got it. She's really got it bad.
I thought this was for my daughter. we just found out that the women all have lunch at the... We just have a backup in case one of us messes up. Which
is February 10th, 1992. Lisa Fine and Shirley Bradley at the Ariel's Museum were interviewing Arthur Fram on Real Memories.
Okay, you're going to need to remind us what
someone
told us.
I hope you have questions, because I'm not sure where you want to start.
Yes, we do.
We have plenty of questions.
Okay.
There's
so many variations and memories and things that I think we all remember, and some are good, some are bad.
Right. First, you need to remind us when you worked there and what your job was at Rio.
Okay. I went to work there in March of 1947. And left in March of 72.
You were almost there, to the end, weren't you?
Right. And I began work at Diamond Rio in the accounts payable department.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to check invoices with purchase orders for accuracy.
Okay. And where did you end up going to?
Pardon?
Where did you end up?
Oh, I see. Then I remember I didn't particularly like this job because it was a stressful and uninteresting. And one day this fellow that had the service purchasing department on the third floor came down. He said, I'd like to work upstairs for me. I said, tell me what it's all about. He did. I said, I'm ready to go. And the funniest thing was that Carl Godfrey, who had been at Diamond Rio, or Rio Motors at one time and Diamond Rio later, he went to work many, many years ago when they were still making passenger cars.
Mm-hmm. Before 37, 36.
Yes. And he became purchasing agents for truck service parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I became what they call an expediter. I think there were two others beside myself and two girls, and it was a big operation.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the parts that went into trucks from here on back, he bought and put into stock, and then the branches and
would call if they needed something.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to know what you physically had to do in that department.
Oh, in that particular job, we had purchase orders, of course, and we had copies went to the supplier,
mm-hmm.
and we had copies in the cost department. We had copies of follow-up copy, which was a stiff back copy, and it gave the part number at the top and the vendor and what the item was or how many and if it was scheduled over a long period of time and so forth. And when we each day went through these files and made sure that the supplier was shipping correctly, and
mm-hmm.
if he hadn't been, why he hadn't been.
Mm-hmm.
And this involved many times actually going to the supplier and see what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting job. I really enjoyed it. And Carl Godfrey was a real whiz, because he kept the cost up to date currently. In other words, if a vendor changed a price, ordinarily in most companies, that particular change doesn't occur until later. They wait.
Mm-hmm.
This was almost immediately, so that we in turn could increase our prices to our branches mm-hmm. and customers. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that job, and I don't recall how long I worked for him, but when he retired, then they asked me if I'd like to have that job, mm-hmm. which I did.
So you were the head of the
right.
department?
In fact, it was amusing because Jim Durden, who was vice president of the company at that time, and I remember he came up to me and he said, "Do you think you can handle it?" I said, "Certainly I can. I've been here X number of years, and I'm very familiar with what the operation mm-hmm. consists of." And also then, we started to build military trucks, and so we were buying military parts and commercial mm-hmm. truck parts.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to back up a bit, I don't know if you were aware, but it's not publicized too much, but Diamond Rio Motors at that time was really one of the first companies to build a power lawnmower for
yes.
home use.
Right.
And so I bought lawnmower service parts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I have three divisions, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that job went on for a long, long time. And then when White Motors bought Diamond Rio, first a merger came, Diamond Rio and Rio Motors combined. And then White Motors of Cleveland purchased the Diamond Rio operation.
This was in the 60s, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the decision was made to move the purchasing of service parts to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they offered me the opportunity to go down there. Well, I went down and looked, and there were several things against the move. First place, the money wasn't there, and secondly, there was more expensive living costs there. And I had to uproot my family to move there mm-hmm. for less money. It was kind of ridiculous. And they would not pay the moving expenses either. So I turned it down, and it made the director of purchasing at Diamond Rio angry.
Mm-hmm.
But I had enough seniority there, so they kind of kept me just around downstairs in the main purchasing department. Well, it wasn't too long, and Frank Huxtable, who was buying what they called non-productive materials and services, he retired. Also, that's back up a second. He was also buying what they called fasteners, which included bolts, nuts, washers, clips,
mm.
small items. Well, when he retired, they offered me that job, so in turn, I got that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very interesting job, because I bought everything from let's say, roof repairs to furniture, engineering.
Oh, anything that the plant needed.
Yes, everything yeah. everything in that was used in the plant offices that was not used on the truck itself.
I see.
Because I used to get out in the plant several times a day, and I learned to know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a big family operation, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
That was truly interesting, because I can recall many incidents that happened there. Some good, like I say, some good, some bad.
Yeah.
Well, we'd like to hear both.
You know, here's an interesting thing. When I was when we were buying military service parts, well, that included everything imaginable, from the engine to the transmission to the body to the all of these things. And I remember one thing was transmission gears. Well, those are highly precision ground, and they're packed individually. And I walked out one day into the plant where they were packaging these parts. There was a guy, an employee, throwing those gears into a gondola. God, I got one of the supervisors. Says, "You know what that guy is doing? Those gears cost us like $42 a piece, and he's tossing like you're tossing wood. Just a nickel will ruin them." And of course, then there was some many interesting things happened. What, for example, ordnance department, we had ordnance inspectors in there to inspect those parts before they went into the boxes or containers for shipping to different ordnance depots.
Mm-hmm. These were meant for the military?
Yes, military. And I remember that we got a call one day from the boxing department. They were holding up a shipment of chains. Now, these chains come from manufacturer in, let's say, 10-foot lengths, and they're used to move one truck to another. That was down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was funny how they packed them. They put them in a barrel and rolled them like that. So they, and the ordnance department was complaining because the paint was chipping off.
Of the chains or the barrel?
Of the chains. And
doesn't affect its performance.
No, how are you going to prevent that?
Yeah.
And I'm never going to shut down a fax department. So I told them.
Well, I suppose they could wrap them, right?
Pardon?
Wrap the chain.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Wrap them in oil or
something. But anyway, the head of the person department called the ordnance Detroit, and they got that
cleared up. Yeah.
Yeah, got that cleared up.
That wouldn't affect the performance of the chain.
No, not at all.
A truck out of the mud.
You could take the move the chain from here to there, and it'd be a paint off.
Let me ask you, you're talking about suppliers in engines and all these different parts. All those things came from small shops around Michigan?
Well, not necessarily. Big shops, small shops, wherever. It could be anywhere from right in Lansing to New York or California or Texas, Florida.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I guess I just thought everything for the real truck was made in the real factory.
Well, no.
That's not so.
No, see, everything... The only things that really were made at the factory were the chassis frames, and that was made on channel, which was assembled, you might say, at Diamond Rail. Then the engines, they were built at Diamond Rail. The crankshafts, the camshafts, transmissions and axles and everything else.
And they stamped out the bodies, right? Here?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we actually, we had a sheet metal plant, and they built the bodies here.
Okay.
What else I want to tell you? Many, many things I'm trying to remember.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the wheels and the tires and all of that.
Oh, I know what I was going to tell you. You know, there's always a problem. I think even the big three find this, that there are some things that are difficult to get. I mean, delivery is too long a time,
mm-hmm.
and consequently demand is greater than the supply. So we had a couple of things happen that really were amusing in one way. When I was buying service parts for the trucks, we were buying the axle came from what was known at that time Timken Detroit Axle, now it's Rockwell Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And my turn, I was buying the axle shafts. Well, it just seemed that we could not get enough axle shafts from Timken to keep the customers of ours happy. So it was always a screaming, yelling that, we're going to ship us those axle shafts. So one day a fellow came in that I knew from Detroit. He came in, he said, Art, he said, there's a firm in Chicago, I want you to see it, who are building truck axle shaft. That's the only thing they're building.
Mm.
He said, I'd like to have you see the plant and see what you think about it. So we flew from here, out here at Capsule Airport, to Chicago, on the plant, very, very good operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back, and I talked to my boss, and I told him about the situation. He said, sure, go ahead and get them. We'll get out of trouble. It wasn't only a few months later that the service manager started raising hell about it, because he said, well, that cancels our warranty with Timken Detroit axle.
Oh, on the trucks that have those axles in them already.
Right. But then we find out later that we called the legal, we had a legal staff there too.
Uh-huh.
We talked to him, and he said, if Timken Axle cannot supply them, and you can get them, and they're a quality product, it's fine. He says, and they cannot nullify your warranty because they cannot supply the axle shaft. So that was another.
Mm. You had your own legal staff at the factory?
Pardon?
You had lawyers on staff?
We had one attorney and a girl.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that before.
No, I hadn't either. No. But it makes sense, because obviously these kinds of questions come up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had a lot of questions come up, legal questions.
Right. I bet you did.
Did you have any parts or any materials come in from overseas anywhere? That you didn't import anything?
Sure.
Everything was U.S. made.
All right. But in fact, this, we had, this is interesting how things, when it came to military parts, you know, like I said, we tried to, where possible, to supply, give those orders to small firms.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this until a short time later. I was buying a part from a little firm here in Lansing, underneath the Kalamazoo Street Bridge. There's a Selhard product. You remember that? Anyway, come to find out, it's a second cousin of mine.
Oh.
And he was building parts and doing a good job too. But when this bankruptcy thing came into play, the IRS came in there, of course, and they froze everything, you might say. I'll never forget, Ken was shipping, Ken Hartzell, his name, his company was Selhard, Hartzell spelled backwards.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. A little firm he probably had maybe 3-4 employees, and they're doing a good job, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember, let's say the figure was $6,000 that he had coming. So the accounts payable department paid the bill. Well, the IRS came back to him and said, well, you weren't, or come back to us and also him, that we were not supposed to pay those bills, supposed to be approved by IRS first.
Oh.
So they went to Ken and told me to pay the money back. He said,
right.
The hell with you. He closed the door and went to Florida.
You know, you don't think about that, but when a company like Rio goes out of business, it's not just the people who work in the company, it's all the other, the suppliers, you know.
Oh, yes. You know, here's a little firm that was, they were doing a fine job.
Yeah.
And that little money they were getting was their payroll and their expenses.
Mm-hmm. And that reports, you know, a number of other people.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Everything's related into the automotive industry from the early 1900s. Right,
yeah.
You know, everything, it spreads out like a ripple effect.
Oh,
yeah. It's
just
so interesting.
Yeah, and if things go bad, it fillers down through all the small firms, too.
Right. How did you end up at the Rio to begin with?
Oh, I went in the service.
Right, I remember you mentioning that
right.
When we were at lunch.
And I worked at Oldsmobile Library, and I'll just say this, that's one thing I regret now.
Mm.
Two legged, you can't do back up and live off. But when I came back in the service, when I went in the service, I worked for Oldsmobile, and I had a good job, which was, it was called detail car inspection.
Mm-hmm.
I had a license plate and a pass, and my job was to go to the warehouse and pick up a car at random, bring it back to the engineering department, put up on a hoist, go through it with a fine-tooth comb, inside and out, and make a report on it. Take it out and road test it, and bring it back. And geez, that's a wonderful job.
Sure is.
How old were you then?
And then the war came. And I remember that they closed that operation, and I went to work in the gauge division, which was a nice job too, because we were making 20 millimeter gun barrels, other military parts.
Oh, they were already starting with the military.
Right,
I
right.
See.
So we were, like I say, the commercial thing had more or less ceased, and now we were in the military.
Yeah, you should tell us, you know, how old you were and what years
let's see.
You can remember.
Oh.
So when the war first broke out, you were still too young. You were still working in Oldsmobile.
Right, right. See, I went into the service in 43. I was, I can't even tell my own age now. I was 29. I was married and had one child.
Oh, you were?
Yes.
And you got drafted.
Right. Well, that's another thing that really grinded me. I had a child, I had an idle wife, and I asked for deferment. And I was working there in that gauge division, which was a military part.
so.
No,
it didn't
not
make
quite
it.
Yet. And I never forget this, and this kind of really got to me, and the other fellows the same way. The girl, I think this was a woman that worked for Brando, and he had charge of the deferments at Oldsmobile.
Mm.
Her husband never went in the service.
Oh.
So there's politics again. Mm-hmm. So we went, and when I came back...
You were born in 1914?
Pardon?
No. What year were you
1950.
Born? 1950.
Right.
You don't look your age.
Thank you. So when I come back from the service, we had sold our house before I left, and we went to my wife's parents who lived in Coldwater, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And I laid around for a month or two, and then I got upset, and I went to work for a firm called Federal Mogul.
Yes.
Well, let's see, maybe I should back up a second. I'm trying to think how this works. No. I remember when I got back home from the service, I went to Oldsmobile, and...
Try to get your old job back?
Try to get my old job back. Wasn't available.
Nothing there.
I thought they had to hold jobs for the returning servicemen.
Yeah, that was an outright lie.
Was it really?
It really was an outright lie.
It wasn't a lie if you got it, but it was a lie if you didn't. I guess.
Oh, I just thought that was...
Because some guys told us that they had their jobs back when they came back.
Well, you know, that. So they offered me a job in the... press plant checking shell noses. They're still making military, they were.
Mm-hmm. Where were they?
And God, what a dirty, noisy place. I just couldn't stomach that. I went to the union and complained about it because I was a member of the union. No, he said, we can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. We couldn't.
No. You know, and I realized later that I made a serious mistake. I should have gone to the home of the father I worked for before.
Oh, from Oldsmobile?
Yes.
Yeah.
Went to his house personally, and I think I would have gotten back into that particular position.
Oh.
So I became discouraged, and I went back to Coldwater, and I went to work for Federal Mogul. It was an outfit that made rod bearings for engines, car engines.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there for a year and a half, but living with your wife's parents isn't no way. You know how that's...
Not when you've got your own family.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I came back to Lansing and rented a house, and I went to Rio, and a friend of mine was in the cost department, and I talked to him. He said, we've got openings here. So I got a job with...
Mm-hmm.
Short, within a few, just a few days, went to work.
Did you think that was a good place? I mean, obviously you would have preferred to go back to Olds, but
Rio
was okay.
So.
Yeah.
Definitely so.
Yeah.
And you can't brood about it or feel bad about it.
Right.
We all of us lost our pensions, literally. We did.
Yes.
We don't
have
any pension.
We
don't
know. So it's scraping.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we heard about that from other people, too.
Yeah, I can believe you did, too.
But if you'd been able to go to... You would have preferred to go to Olds because you'd worked there before?
Yes.
Because the pay was better?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, pay was much better, and then secondly, too, they carried your seniority when, in the time you were in the service. See, if I went to work there in 35 and left in 43, so I had 8+... Service time.
Mm-hmm. So when you started to reel, you had to start from the bottom.
Right, from scratch, really.
Yeah.
Who was your friend in cost accounting that helped you get in?
Pardon?
Who was your friend in cost?
Oh, Otto Gerginski.
Otto?
Gerginski. His mother was my godmother.
Oh.
Oh. How would you spell his name, do you think?
G-E-R.
G-E-R.
G-I-N. S-K-I.
Thank you. We have someone that's going to be typing this up later, and I can imagine them hearing this on the tape and not knowing how to do this. Okay.
And
Thank you.
Then I went to work in the accounts payable department for a man named Howard Viges, V-I-G-E-S. He was a nice guy, but I don't know. We had so many personnel changes in that diamond reel that
you
couldn't keep our reel motors and diamond reel all the time. That changes. They brought a fella in as we had first was Enno Schraft was comptroller, and then he became ill, I think, and left. And then Howard Vi just Joe Newman came in as comptroller. And I don't have any discriminatory thoughts, but he was a Jewish guy who would just, he used to stand at the back of the room and yell at Howard. Howard, like you're calling a dog. I felt so sorry for Howard because he was such a good guy and had to put up with that. And I think actually it killed him because he died of a heart attack not too many months after
that. Stress built up. You're saying every time that the Rio underwent new management, they brought in new people?
Oh, I got, that's another incident. God, you cannot believe. Jeez. We had so many inept, incapable people that came in positions of big positions. And every time, this is amusing in one way, yet it was ridiculous. For example, manufacturing manager. Now, he would be directly under the president of the company. They might even label him as a vice president. We had changes continually. Every time you get a new manufacturing manager, I get a call. Mr. So-and-so wants to see you. Go up there. He'd want new furniture, new carpeting, new drapes.
I'll buy
all that stuff. And we had this, and you know, the thing that makes you mad is that so many of these birds were, they had a big ego. This one fella, he became, I don't know if he still is, head of the Liquor Control Commission in Michigan. I can't think of his name right now. But he called me in. He came there from Clark Equipment. And he said, I want a new desk and a credenza and chair and carpeting and this and that. And he said, I want you to contact Sears Commercial Sales. Well, I told him, fine, I'd be glad to, but I want you to know that we had experience before with them. The delivery is bad. Oh, I said, it's not either. I bought it from when I was a clerk. I said, okay, it's your baby. That's true. We waited for months for this.
Oh, Lord.
Months and months. And then one day he called me in, and that furniture, it was nice. I'll have to say, it was an all furniture. It was nice furniture. He brought me in, and I remember there was a swivel chair and I think four side chairs. Well, he said, now see that side chair? It's a little bit crooked.
It doesn't have the more important to worry about, right?
Right. Such insignificant things. And then, you know, I couldn't see it. So after he had gone to lunch, I brought a couple of other people in from purchasing. I says, can you see anything wrong with these chairs? He looked them over thoroughly. No.
Not to mention, your salary is worth more than that. I mean, you know, you're being paid to do more than that, too.
That's exactly right. It was just peanuts and nothing important.
Unbelievable.
Well, then I got another incident. This might be interesting to you, too. Claire Laudenslager was the last manufacturing manager.
Now, we've heard his name before.
Quite often.
Yeah.
Heard him a lot.
Before, he'd been at Rio at one time and then left, and then he became a sales representative. And again, this was at the time when I was buying non-production. And one of the things I bought for non-production were parts, materials for the maintenance department, which included forklift trucks. Mm. We had a lot of those.
Oh,
gasoline,
yes.
Propane, electrics. And among them was, I think we had two long arm cranes. Well, those lift trucks were old, really old. A good share of them, actually most of them were purchased from Clark Equipment. Good product. But 25 years old.
Mm.
So we were always tied up on lift truck parts. Again, this Claire came in, he said, I've got a source in Chicago which builds lift truck parts. That's their specialty. So I want you to see it. So then we flew down to Chicago. Good operation. Excellent operation. And I remember calling, when I used to call it Hark Equipment, they always wanted the serial number and the model number. And I'd say, we need this particular part, need it right away. And they'd laugh. So we just continued to count that. This going to get that truck 10 years ago. Yeah, I got so I didn't get mad about it because I don't know it was true. So, Claire came, so I looked the plan over, and this was how conscientious Claire was. You can say everything you want about him, but he was really conscientious. He was to get in his personal car and drive to Chicago to get us lift truck parts.
Is that right? On his own expense?
His own expense, right. And he'd done this any number of times. Mm. And I was criticized for doing that. We got a new master mechanic come in from Ford. He says, that's not ethical. I said, what do you want to do? You want to let that equipment sit there?
Yeah, right.
When it's needed on the floor.
It's needed, it's needed. We had one of those lift cranes, long arm cranes out in the export department, which was used to lift those big wooden boxes onto mm-hmm. box or rail cars.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, we were lost.
Absolutely. Couldn't load stuff out.
And when he became manufacturing manager, I'll have to say that, to me, he was the only one I've ever had that knew what the score was and what he was doing. He was rough, but he got the production out, and it was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I still maintain that if they had seen their way clear and left him there to run that place, it would be going today.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
A good example of what he'd done was, we had one of the best surface transportation lines in the United States, CATA. That was his baby.
Oh, what?
Right.
Huh.
He developed that, designed it, and became the manager.
Hmm.
When he left
Rio.
Oh, he did. That's mm-hmm. where he went after Rio.
Oh, back up a minute, too. I never forget. When he came into the plant as on Rio payroll again, I'll tell him about Joe New, about this guy that was manufactured, remember that, with that Sears furniture?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
He said, we're going to get rid of that guy. He's one of the first guys that's going to go.
Oh.
Remember, I know how it happened, but one of the fellows was standing in the lobby. Claire walked into this guy's office. He says to him, called Clark Newell, N-E-W-E-L-L. He said, get your things and get out of here. You're through. Just like that.
Wow.
Wasn't any advance notice. Bang, he was out.
Did he get to take his crooked chair with him?
No.
The next person had a little furniture, unfortunately.
I think another thing might be interesting is how this thing functioned after Capper bought it. Is this one something you might want to know?
Sure.
Oh. Yeah, we've heard a lot about that from other people, too.
Yes.
Capper was an individual who was involved in the manufacture of mobile homes.
Oh, I didn't know.
I didn't know that.
He had no knowledge.
Down in Mississippi is where he's from?
Right.
Yeah.
And he had no knowledge of truck manufacturing at all. And he had pet ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He brought with him Mildred Johnson.
We've heard about her.
She was vice president, and she was his mistress.
Oh, she was?
Yeah, he was married, but that was his mistress.
I see.
And she told him that she would reduce that payroll the first year by, I think the figure was $900,000. Well, that affected us.
Mm.
So every day, she'd call one person into her office, same procedure. She'd ask you to sit down. She'd open her desk drawer, hand you a slip, and at the top of it said, my resignation.
Oh.
The same procedure every day, one a day. I remember, I was one of them. And I looked at her, I says, what for? She says, we have our reasons. I said, I want to know what they are. We don't have not to tell you. I said, I refuse to sign it. And they hand your choke drawer again, hand your You're fired. Yeah. I never get this Al Axline, who was in personnel. He told her very bluntly, he said, you go to hell.
Oh, my.
Couldn't the union intervene?
No. See,
to help you?
They're supervisory.
See, if you were 50 years old or older.
Oh, yes, that's right, of course.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking.
If you had a supervisory position and a good salary and seniority, you were alive for the
date. Oh, yes.
Date.
Yes, I see that.
There was 37 of us that got it every day. And then the payoff was, true, she cut the payroll, but she put in people who had absolutely no experience.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them were just graduates from Michigan State University. Young guys in good intentions, but no knowledge.
No experience
or knowledge.
They could pay probably a quarter.
Oh, yeah, they paid them just peanuts in comparison. Some guys used to call me at home and tell me what was going on.
Oh. Mm.
And then the gall, I think what added to more than anything to the thing was that these very people who replaced us, some of them had the guts to call us at home and ask us how to do this.
God. Oh, my. And you, of course, would tell them.
Yeah, that's really... Yeah, you can imagine what the reply was.
Well, and who could blame you?
Pardon?
I say, and who could blame you?
Yeah.
Goodness. I guess I'd like to go back at the very beginning for just a second and just ask you what your background was before you came to the shop. Were you from... Did you live in Lansing? Did
yeah,
your family...
I was born and raised in Lansing. Graduated from Eastern High School. Took some courses at MSU.
What kind of courses?
I never got my degree at MSU.
Engineering type things?
Right. I took higher mathematics, which included calculus and trig and geometry. And I took I remember that... Oh, there are many courses. I don't recall them all. But when I got into purchasing at Diamond Rio, I took a course in purchasing at MSU.
In the business school by then.
Pardon?
Yeah. By then it was the business school.
Right.
Yeah.
John Hoagland taught it.
Yeah.
John?
Hoagland.
Oh, Hoagland. Okay.
Yeah, H-O-A-G-L.
L-A-N-D.
Do you know him by chance?
I've heard his name.
Probably have.
Yeah, I've heard his name. And you were doing this, originally going to courses at MSU, probably was in the Depression, right, in the 30s.
Right, it was, see, it would have been, I graduated from Eastern in 34,
uh-huh.
So that was right in the middle, you might
right,
have
that's
Depression,
right. Yes,
and
there were
jobs,
no jobs
were just unavailable.
So you might as well go to school because there's not much else to do. You might as well go to school because there's
that's
not
right,
much
exactly.
else to do.
That's right, exactly. In fact, I used to go to school. I used to go to spend a lot of time in the library, too.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how an airplane engine runs and the things of this nature. Again, curiosity.
Mm-hmm. And that's how you were able to get your first job at Ohl's from
right.
the kinds of courses that you got.
Right.
Yeah.
I had a bat. That was... Now, there's another thing. I think that... You know, you talk so much about getting ahead in life. I think I was raised in a family where there was no affection. My father was an individual who didn't like work particularly. You know, would stay in bed and sleep.
What did he do when he did work?
Sleep.
No.
Oh, he didn't
I'm
have
sorry, but I'm telling you this.
Really? Did your mom work? Did she support the family?
No. It was just And I remember going to school in my bear hanging out, you know,
oh.
times. You know, you felt. So from the time I was about 14, I went to work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't put up with this.
How did your family survive without him having a regular job?
Well, at that particular time, it worked maybe a couple of days and home a couple of days. It's just enough to get by.
Yeah.
And the home that we lived in was one that my father's. My dad's parents had left to him, so...
He didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Oh, so you didn't have house...
No, other than the lights and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And
food.
Food, yeah.
Clothes.
God.
Shoes.
God, that's right.
Did you have lots of brothers and sisters? And was this a large
Pardon?
Large family that your mother had
no,
to
my,
try and take care of?
I only had one brother.
Uh-huh.
We lived on North Pennsylvania Avenue. There's an apartment house there, by the way, now. And I remember I went to... I was in the sixth grade. I remember going to school, Oak Park School, and a kid came from the school this way, and he said, Artie, said, something about some big event had happened. Journalist extras are out. So I went to the mountain and found out some papers. So
a paper boy.
You could do that if they put on an extra, they take on extra help, and you could.
Right, right.
How much money would you make from something like that? 2 cents.
Made $6 that day.
$6. Oh, you were selling papers all day.
A lot of money at that
that's
time.
Good. Yeah.
You were on the streets downtown Lansing, shouting out that you had.
So from that point on, I was a newsboy downtown. Mm-hmm. I sold papers downtown, and I built myself a route among the stores and offices and departments downtown. I had 40 some customers. That was a private route, nothing to do with State Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good thing too.
Oh. How would you build a route? You go in to say our boss, and you'd say, I'd like to come in here and sell papers.
Right. I'd like to the dress shops, and the candy stores and so forth. And those people were always nice to me.
I'm sorry, you're a kid.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and it did the service for them, because they didn't
that's
have
right.
time to rent out.
Oh, sure, food. That's
it's
right.
Cold, or
was there one edition a day then, or did you do this, like, was there a morning edition and an evening?
No, it was in the afternoon edition. I think
after school?
Yeah, after school.
Oh,
the paper
came
out at 3 o'clock. I was there probably at 4, and I'd get home probably about 6 o'clock then. And I sold papers in between times, and then summertime, of course, it was full all every day.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there was again some funny incidents, because on a rainy day, you can't sell papers.
Is that
right? They just don't sell. No, seriously. And I remember, I think I was bought 10 papers, then I sold them and go get 10 more. Walking down Michigan Avenue, papers, rainy day, well, what are you going to do with these papers? I looked in the gutter, full of water, flowing. There was a green piece of paper, two $1 bills.
Oh, my goodness.
Put the papers in a waste basket in the trash can and went home. So I learned what made that tape.
Oh, my goodness.
And these people who were my customers downtown, I had some wonderful people of customers. I remember some of the dress shops. One called Penn. I'll never forget her, this woman. She says, Art, would you feel bad if I gave you an overcoat that my nephew had?
No.
So the day before Christmas, she had a box all nicely wrapped.
Oh, that's nice.
And it was a beautiful coat from Marshall Fields.
It had
never been worn.
Oh, my.
Another customer I had was a fellow that ran an appliance operation up on Capitol Avenue. Right now we're at the corner of Capitol and Washtenaw. There's a Michigan Accident Fund, I think, in that building. Anyway.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Chris, I'll never forget him. One day I was down in the summertime selling papers, overhauls, kind of ragged looking, really. And he says, "You had your lunch yet?" I said, "No." "How about lunch with me?" Oh, I said, "I'm not really impressed with that." I says, "Come on, they won't even see that." We went into Murray Stewart's, with a really top-notch restaurant.
Oh, okay.
What was it?
He'd done this repeatedly, too.
Oh, the Murray Stewart?
Yeah.
Restaurant? That was right on Washington Avenue, perhaps?
No, it was on Michigan, right down between Washington and Grand.
Okay.
And he let you order whatever you wanted?
Yes. I'll never forget roast beef. God, that was more than I had at home for a family.
Oh, my goodness. And this was all during the 30s.
Yeah. And then I graduated from that. I was selling papers. I had this customer that had the Opera House Cleaners, which was hats and clothing and shoe shine parlor. And George said to me one day, "I'd like to shine shoes." I said, "How much you pay?" "Fine. More money I can make on newspapers." So I said, "Fine." So he taught me there, and I worked for him all the way through part of junior high and high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I got so I could shine shoes with white flannel on no apron. And you can do that so good that you can do it blindfolded almost.
Yeah, really.
And then another nice thing about it was there were two Greeks, George Poulos and George Paspas, Big George and Little George.
Oh, yes.
And they more or less adopted me. I had a bad situation at home. Uh-huh. I used to go to all the Greek weddings and baptisms and name days.
Too.
Oh, good food. Never forget the first time we went to the wedding on Sunday at Jackson, Greek wedding. Big affair. Lots of food. Mm. Wonderful time.
Yeah.
And I worked for them a long time.
What'd you do with the money you made?
Well, I used it to buy clothes.
Clothes for yourself, yeah. So you could go to school.
Right, because I had to keep myself dressed.
Yeah.
Didn't make that much anyway, but at least it helped. I banked a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
The, even in that kind of business, you run into some strange incidents. One day a guy came in for a shoe shine on a Saturday morning, and his shoe was rather filthy. It was sawdust, and shoes, shines at the time were 10 cents. He got down to hand me a dollar, and I went to get the change. He said, forget it, that's something. Wow. So from that time on, I was his shoeshine boy. Every time he got down, he'd give me a dollar.
Wow.
And I come to find out he was the owner of Farmer Pete's Packing. I built that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, he got a good shine from that time on.
Did you have a regular shoeshine stand in one of the buildings? Did you have a regular shoeshine stand in one of the buildings down
there? No, they owned the building and had about five stands, you might say, in the building.
And I guess I'd forgotten where that was.
It was next to the Gladmer Theater when that was still open.
Oh, North Washington.
Right, North Washington.
Mm. Okay. And it was a cleaners?
Yeah, Opera House Cleaners.
Opera House Cleaners. Okay, thank you.
I'm still keeping contact with their children.
Oh, really? Right. Oh. And you decided to go into the plants because you thought it was a good opportunity for you?
Yes, the money was there. That was
good money? Yeah.
Right. And I didn't have any other... I really didn't have any other experience or, knowledge. And I probably could have in some other field, but...
We asked you about your debt because lots of the other people in the plant went in because their fathers went in. You know, it's the kind of thing
that's
you
right.
With your family. You know, your brothers or your father or sometimes even your mother or sisters.
I went to work at Olsenville. When I first went, that was a terrible job. Jeez.
What did you first do?
Why
there?
Was it terrible?
I went to work, and I remember I went to work. It was on the midnight shift.
Oh.
It was the worst time. You can't sleep, you can't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working, running a drill press. Drilling.
Well, you were really on the line when you first started. You were really on the line.
Oh, God.
Drill press is hard work.
Yeah.
Drill press. Shaving. My hands were always full of steel.
Oh, yes.
Slivers get festered up. And I was determined to get out of that thing. I just figured that's no place to make a living. What convinced me for sure was, right next to me was a little Polish guy, and I have to admire him, but yet, he'd been on that same job like 20 years. I thought, God, I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He was an automat, a robot. So from that point on, I decided I'm going to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked through the roster, the Oldsmobile. I thought, well, inspection is a good field. I've been around the plant now. So I called, I went to the office of Ken Plasterer. It's Plasterer.
Plasterer.
Yeah.
Just like it sounds.
Right. And he was chief inspector for Oldsmobile. And I asked his secretary if I could talk to him. He said, what about? I said, I'd like to go to work in the inspection department. Well, he said, we just can't let you go in. I said, okay, I'll wait. I went back in 2 weeks. I took her a box of candy, same deal. And she said, well, I'll let you know.
Depends if the candy's good.
So I went back a week later. She said, I'll call you. So I thought, well, I can wipe that one off. A week later, I got a telephone call.
Wow.
She said, this is so-and-so, Mr. Plasterer, glad to see you at that particular time. It was time when I wasn't working. I was night since it was daytime.
Uh-huh.
And so I talked to him, and he was most discouraging. He said to me, he says, of course, you know you're going to take a pay cut if you work, come to work for inspection. I said, I don't care. I want to get off that production job. And he didn't give me much encouragement, but I kept bugging.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was at my job at production, and the farmer came over and says, we got a slip for transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a happy day. And that was days all the time, too. And the first, inspection job wasn't the best, I'll have to say that. But I kept bugging there again, too.
Yeah.
Because it was a job where you checked the, to make sure that the transmission and differential had oil in them. Dirty job.
Yeah.
But it was a step away from production.
Right, it was a start.
And then I remember that I kept bugging this foreman to the, an opening somewhere else. That moved to receiving inspection, which was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now from there, it went to detailed car engineering.
Mm-hmm. Your education probably helped a little bit.
Yes,
too,
I think it did.
Because you had high school and
right.
College too. Were you there during the strike in 37?
Well, he didn't start
until
40.
Yes, I
think there was a strike at Alt too. Ultimate wasn't there?
I don't remember that strike.
I think there
That's
was.
Funny.
Maybe I'm wrong, because I haven't done all the work on Oldsmobile that I've done on Rio. Rio had a big strike in 37.
Oh, yes, they did have.
Yeah. Maybe it wasn't that big a deal. They had a big, GM had a big strike in Flint.
Oh, that's
too.
Right. I remember that. Very destructive strike, wasn't
right.
it?
Right. That was very violent. The one in Rio was not.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And then in 37, in June, they had the labor holiday. Do you remember anything about that?
What?
Obviously not. There was a big labor holiday in June of 1937. Remember when the city went closed down?
Oh, yes, yes, I do.
Do you remember that?
Right, I do.
What'd you do?
I don't remember.
I wonder if the schools closed too on that.
No,
it's just businesses.
It's just the businesses.
Just businesses.
Yeah, because I've read the newspapers.
Right. What about the State Journal? It must have been closed that day then. Maybe you didn't sell papers. Although they would stay open and report.
They were, yeah, they were open. Yeah, they were open.
Right.
And they had the workers marched downtown. And they marched to East Lansing, got into fights with the students.
Oh, I do remember that, yes.
The Battle of the Red Cedar, it was called.
That was a big riot in Flint, too.
That's right, yeah. Did you belong to the union then, when you were working at Alls?
Yes, yes.
Excuse me. But when you got higher up in the inspector jobs, obviously you had to...
Well, apparently it still was, because I think all hourly people were...
Oh, well, hourly people.
...belong to the union.
Okay. So you just, by the time you started in Olson, there was already a union there.
Yes,
there wasn't any
yes.
Union. Okay.
Do you recall how much money you made, say, hourly at Olson? And when you started at Rio, you were hourly too, weren't you?
No, we were on salary.
Oh, you started on salary at Rio. Oh, okay.
Right.
I was just wondering how the pay scale was then.
Oh, I pay it. How that's changed over the years, too.
Hasn't it, though? This would have been after the war when you went to Rio, and it was just...
Right, it was after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even recall what I started, how much I made at that
point. I know
point.
My...
You said at the beginning, though, that you made less than when you had... Or it seemed like it was less than when you had left Olds before the war.
Yes.
Right? You took a little bit of a cut.
Right.
I know my mother worked at Rio. She started during the war, and she was there up until the 50s. And it seemed like everything taken out, she could bring home $35 a week, say.
Where did she work there?
She worked in the receiving department. She worked on lawnmowers later.
Oh.
She wound the armatures and the motors.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else she did there.
What?
I know she was on the receiving docks.
What year was this? What year was this?
When I was in high school, 47, 48, 49.
Oh, that's just the time I went there, then.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, and I think her take-home pay was, during those years, was about $35 a week. And I remember that because our apartment rented for $35 a month. And we thought that we had all the money in the world.
Right.
You know. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have a car or anything like that, so we didn't have those expenses. But that was considered good money.
God, that's unbelievable. Inflation.
Oh, isn't it, though?
Pardon?
Inflation.
Right.
Yeah. By the time you started at Rio, all the strikes were just about over, too. The coal strike and the steel strike and the railroad strike and...
All the stuff after the war.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then the changeover to peacetime production. And I know people had to wait on the waiting list to get a car or
right, and
after
then
the war.
I remember that even after the so-called strike, there were strikes periodically, different places. Mm-hmm. And we went through one at real when I was there. I remember that.
Do you? What kind of a strike was that?
In the 50s, 60s?
Right, because I remember that the head of the union got up, which was illegal. I think he was in jail for it, too. He got one of those big wire cutters and cut the chain because we... Rio had locked them out.
Oh,
they locked the workers out?
Right.
What was the strike over?
I don't remember.
Maybe higher pay or better benefits?
Well, I think it was. I don't remember definitely, but that was, you know, there's again a case where, I remember back there I was telling you about Al Axelon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good friends with that guy today, and I remember he was in personnel. He was a tough guy to deal with, but he was honest and fair. And I remember that at one time I was talking to him, I said, what do you have as far as grievances? Are they all good ones? He says, no. He says, come over, I want to show you. He had a book there,
mm-hmm.
of grievances, some of the silliest damn things you could ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I remember that very distinctly. There was a drinking fountain, let's say, at the corner of this desk, and they walked out because they wanted drinking fountain over in that corner. That's a grievance.
Mm-hmm.
He says some of them were legitimate. But he says 90% of them were unreal.
I've heard stories too before about, and in fact, for some of the other people we've interviewed, of the safety problem at the shop at the Rio. Machines maybe that cut off fingers and that kind of thing. So maybe some of the grievances were for a better working condition.
Well, maybe that was true too.
Yeah.
But when I was buying non-production, I used to get on the plant many, many times every day, and I honestly think that some accidents just happen.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're unavoidable. I think many times the people at work don't take the proper precautions either. In the press plant, I remember that they all had these wristlets that pull them back. Some guys wouldn't put them on because they were uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said earlier about how the plant was like a family.
Yeah.
We've heard that from a lot of people.
For example, they had an organization called the steering wheel.
Well, the steering gear.
Steering gear club,
yeah. And,
right. Did you go to that too?
Yeah. In fact, the year I was let out, I was to be president.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah, because Louis Garcia was telling us that he was. That was one of the proudest moments of his life when he got to be president.
Oh yeah.
Of that. He was very proud of that.
Very much so. And that, I said that was a step I've been looking for a long time, and when it became real, it was out.
And they used to meet at the clubhouse, didn't they?
Yeah, the real clubhouse. I was up on the third floor.
Uh-huh.
The third floor, actually. Yeah. Nice club room. Had a big, Louis Vuitton told a big a gear.
Right, for the chandelier.
Yeah, for the chandelier. Right. Beautiful.
Right. And we heard about the drinks and all sorts of fun things that would go on.
Right.
He was telling us also about the things that the Rio was involved in as far as the community was concerned.
Right.
He talked about the Boy Scout troops, and he talked about Red Cross blood drives.
They were really involved in that sort of thing.
And all the management that were in the club did those things, too.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Remember Al Hansen. Zenon Hansen, who was president, I think.
We've heard his name also. We can't name Zenon.
I think he was there before Kemper bought the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was just a nice guy. He was the kind of a guy who would go through the plant and say, "Hi, Art. Hi, George." And he said, "How you doing?" And he was interested in people, which I think is a good factor for any organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he had strange things about him, too. I'll never forget what... He was from Chicago. He came there from Diamond T, which became merged with...
Right.
Well, and one day he saw me in the hall, and he said, "Art," he said, "we need some new folding chairs for the clubhouse." He says, "I got this company, give me the name in Chicago, will sell that shares for that much money. We had a 500. So I told him, I said, he said, check and see what you can do. And that was FOB Chicago. So I Bill Dietrich, who was a sales rep, to call on me for many years from George Worthington Company here in Lansing, a wholesale wholesale hardware house. They had everything. I called Bill. I said, what can you give me on a lot of 500 folding chairs, metal? And I said, I got to have some information quickly. So I'll call you back within an hour. And I got the price. And it was under the price that he had.
Oh.
Plus, it would deliver to our dock, too. So I took it in. Okay, so that's amazing. Just go and get him.
He was general manager.
Yeah, he was a nice guy.
Was he?
He was a fellow that was very, very supportive and active in the Scouts.
Oh, he was.
Boy Scouts.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, Mr. Cappert apparently was not a person who would come in and get to know anybody or want to do anything civic-minded.
He's very distant.
He wasn't from the area either.
And he, according to what we've heard so far, had no interest really in having Rio continue on.
No. His prime interest was just to liquidate the place. And
tax write-offs.
And the thing that upsets, I think, so many of us is the fact that he was very critical of what we had done in the past, yet he had no better method to show us.
Mm-hmm.
Or a better way to do it, or altering it.
Right. He just wanted to.
Yeah, that's right.
Do away with it. Yeah.
But you all had the feel there in the early 70s that you weren't, that the place wasn't going to stay. Maybe did you kind of think it was kind of shaky?
Well, I think it was. Well, it was to a degree, and particularly I think one that won this rumors and actual selling of it. Of the company,
mm-hmm.
then we became aware of what was happening.
I see.
And we were all fearful of what was happening.
Yeah,
of course.
Sure. You're going to lose your jobs and your benefits
that
you've all worked so hard for.
Yeah.
In fact, I never forget the girl that was my secretary, Betty Gordon. She was just a prince of a gal, and she retired. She's passed away, but she retired and. Before the closing, you might say. So she drew her pension.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, they cut her pension right in half.
Even after she'd retired?
Right. And it happened to other guys, too. Other people there.
So they had no loyalty. They had no...
No. In fact, this is not publicized, but we often wonder how this could happen. But Cappert, it's a known fact that he got $4 million out of the pension fund from the Bank of Lansing, and it's not accounted for.
He just took it?
Took it, that's it.
Hmm.
I want to believe that you always get... Louis Garcia has visited him.
Yeah, we heard all about it.
Yeah, I imagine you did too.
Yeah, Louis was telling us about this man who lives like a king, and and I kept thinking what you just said, that someday there's got to be.
Yeah.
We also have heard that a lot of people, when the end came, they were and lost their pensions and lost their jobs. A lot of them, some of them, committed suicide.
Oh yeah. In fact, this may be an interesting another point too. Being at Rio all this time, there was a fellow upstairs, Bob Block, who headed up the accounts receivable department.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, I think the retirement requirement was, retire 30 years. Again, you retire full pension. 29 years, he was let out. And he went home. And he actually didn't commit suicide, but he literally did, because he went home and he just cut out living. He had a wife at home.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Just withdrew from
everything. In fact, I used to call him, and I'd see Bob. It was a nice day. So I got a couple tickets for Michigan State football game. I know he liked football. I said, let's go up and see the game. No, I can't get out. The phone might ring. They might
so
call me
went
back.
A little bit.
Yeah, he was calling up.
He might call him back.
Yeah. It actually, in fact, his sister, I remember, wrote in the journal what a foul thing happened, and it actually caused this man's death. And I think others, which we don't know about, sure this happened many times.
So she wrote to the State Journal, a letter to the editor or something?
Right.
Saying?
I remember the letter in the State Journal.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Bob Block, B-L-O-C-K?
Yes.
Okay. So there are all kinds of
incidents.
Things that this man caused, all these lives that he...
See, the thing, I think maybe Louis might have mentioned too, that at the very last, Claire Lauenschlager tried to raise money in the area to bring the plant back into operation.
Oh, he did.
And there wasn't enough funding available to salvage it.
They would have hopefully been able to buy it from Capper and keep it going.
Right.
Yeah, there's been a lot of efforts in the last 20 years of the workers trying to buy the plant.
Right. Well, see, some of the employees.
Employers, yeah.
Right, you know, they're over at Charlotte.
Right.
A Spartan.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Louis told us that.
Yeah.
Very successful operation.
That's right.
And Louis told us not, but several years ago, the president of that firm invited us over there for plant tour luncheon.
Oh, nice.
That was nice. The whole group, we went over there.
Great.
We had a good time because you could...
I think it's nice the way Lisa mentioned the family. I think it's so unique the way all of you folks still stay together. And Ed Rankin, we talked with him last week, and he gave me... rosters, picnic rosters all through the years where people in Florida that were real retirees all get together. They get together a lot.
Oh,
they do it here in Lansing. And I can't think of any place else in Lansing where that happens.
No, I don't think there is anything like that.
Especially a big place.
Like Because at one time I don't remember the number, but I know that there were over 2,000 people, maybe about as high as 4,000.
During the war, In the 20s, they had over 5,000.
Yes,
that
that's
Rio,
right.
And that was the heyday when they were making cars and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
That automobile they built. You know, it's a strange thing how you can reminisce and think about this. When I got my first car, it was a used car, and I'll never forget, it was a Pontiac. And it was a junk, right? And this one friend of mine was a sort of an amateur mechanic, and we took and overhauled the engine. Well, we got one of the rod caps on backwards, and it couldn't break it loose. So his father, my father had a diamond, had a Rio Royal.
Royale,
yeah. Oh, he had a Royale, one
monster.
Of the big classics.
Great big car, and felt like a truck, and powerful as a truck. He said, "Let's." He asked his dad to borrow the car and hooked a chain on the front of mine, back of his, tried to break that thing, you know, have it out of gear and then put it in gear and see if it can break it.
Right.
We couldn't break it loose. I'll never forget looking out the back side of the window and see my tires smoking. The wheels were standing still and he was still going.
Ooh, we've got a real Royale out here on the floor.
I know you have.
Seen it.
Beautiful car.
It is beautiful. Looks like it's right out of a gangster movie.
Right, it sure is.
Huge.
Right, exactly.
My dad called
Al Capone's boys.
Yeah, there you go. My dad called them Royals. Well, I guess we call this one a Royale, the same car. But he talked about a problem with the car. If you went around the corner, the door might fly open or something. He said they weren't.
Yeah, the doors were hung the wrong other way.
Yeah.
The back door was.
But he said something about, I'm trying to remember. Something about the car not really being stable or something, because it was maybe
and remember that,
too big for
one
the
of the
frame
first ones to put the automatic transmission out, too.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my father-in-law had one, and he tried to work on it. He wasn't a mechanic.
We've got one of the last flying clouds out there, too, the 1936, and that was the last year that they made cars there.
What year was that?
1936.
36?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had never really come back from the Depression as far as car sales were concerned, and they just got further and further in the hole, so they finally
Of course, other building
cars went to trucks.
Yeah, the other cars were really coming up then.
Plus, they thought, a lot of the books I've read about it said that building the Royale was a stupid move in the 30s when people needed cheap.
Cheap transportation.
People didn't have any for
not these big, luxury cars.
Lux got them up there.
They went down the other direction and made something more inexpensive and smaller and more efficient.
Right.
Well, they did strip down there the 34, 35, 36. I think the cars were more of a stripped down version. They didn't have as much chrome on, and they were trying to make them more cost effective. I think.
Yeah. May have been too little, too late.
Oh, I think it was, because by then they were already you know, money in the hole. I remember neighbors of ours bought a car, and cars when I was a little kid, I remember being either black or cream colored. I'm sure there were others, but I know there were, but that's what you saw the most of. And they bought a cream colored Oldsmobile, and it was a 1936, and it cost $600.
Oh,
and my dad could not get over that. And, and most people didn't have cars in the 30s because of the Depression. Very few people had jobs. My dad finally got a job at the Rio later, but he had to walk from Holt to Lansing every day to get to his job. And maybe they'd work a few hours a day and send him home. But anyway, all the neighbors came for like a mile or two around and walked over to this house to see this car. And my dad just kept, and nobody would touch it. They just kept walking around. You know,
That's funny.
Such a jewel. You know, and my dad kept saying, $600. $600. You can get over that.
Can't even buy a used car for that anymore.
Oh, no, you can't buy anything for that anymore.
Yeah, I think about that sometimes when I go out toward to Friend, or on the left side is that Wiggins VW. How you see a sign there, VW's $11,000. It's hard to believe, really.
Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Incredible. Yeah.
The automotive industry has come from nowhere to its infancy to a giant, and now we don't know what's going to happen to this giant.
That's right.
Yeah.
I
wonder. Mm-hmm. You earlier on you said you sort of expressed regret. You know, if you had been with Olds, all this retirement stuff wouldn't have been a big problem, and you would have had continuous employment and seniority and all of that. Was there any benefits for being at the Rio, though? I mean, as a place to work that you think maybe would have been different if you had stayed at Olds? Because it was a smaller place.
Well, I think, again, the family factor.
Okay.
That's one of the prime things.
Right. The fact that you guys were all very friendly.
Right.
And belonged to the club. And
done things together. And
Yeah. You don't think you would have had that kind of a thing if you had stayed
no,
at Olds?
No, I would not. No, that's true. Very true.
Okay.
And I think at the time the pay scale was comparable to
it was about the same.
Right.
Oh, were
right.
they? I wondered about that.
Yeah, I don't know if it would be if we were still on the line, but perhaps maybe for supervisory people at Marvel, it was pretty competitive.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I say, that's something that you can't back.
No,
you
can't go back.
No. Like just for a contrast, I have a son who's 41 years old. Mm-hmm. When he was in high school, he was a real problem, jeez. My wife and I thought he'd end up in Jackson Prison. I'm serious. God, we were just terrified.
Did he go to high school here in Lansing?
Yeah, he went to Sexton.
Sexton, yeah.
And every other day, he was in a fight with somebody.
Oh, boy.
So we had to put him on a waiver. They had to pay tuition. But he told me, at the time, he said, Dad, he said, I don't want to be discrimination. He said, if the white guy had stuck together there, we could have licked that problem at Sexton.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, a white guy would go out at recess time and three or four blacks would nail him.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I just couldn't put up with that. I'd fight back.
A lot of racial discrimination, you're saying.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say that, it's the funniest thing, when I got out of Diamond, when I let out Dan Rio, I was really at my wit's end, as you can imagine. God, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I walked the floor at night, and one day I told my wife, I says, I'm going to get out of here. I guess, God, I'm going to go crazy. So I went to the bank, got some money, and drove to Florida. I spent 3 weeks in Florida. I walked the beaches every day, part of the night, too. I come back, I got myself back on the street.
Yeah.
But then, My son, I think that time, got out of high school. He wanted to go to college, wasn't sure he wanted to go. But, so, we went into business. A&B Construction, Arden Bryant. And we were, he'd had some experience working with some fellows out there in East Lansing. So we were doing primarily porches and decks and we've got to be experts on hanging doors. We do bathrooms over, recreation rooms. We got some good jobs.
There was a lot of building going on there.
Oh, yes, there was. But then we learned after, shortly thereafter, when Diamond Rio shut down completely, all those same people went into the same kind of business.
Yeah.
God, we had so much competition, you couldn't believe it.
Oh, in the construction business?
Oh, God.
Is that right?
People, guys would bid less than our material costs. You can't win.
No.
And we were put on the bid list, Social Service Department, State of Michigan. We'd get, I put 30-some thousand miles on my car 1 year just running bids. Finally, I called the head of the subsidy. I says, take our name off the list. He says, why? I says, I got a file here that choking ox bids we'd made, never get any business. I said, we'll see about that. So we tried to get a little business from them, but it still wasn't enough. It kept going less and less every year. So he finally got discouraged and left, went to Florida. Well, he's a very aggressive individual, I gotta say that. He got a job with an outfit called Marconi Builders, like Marconi, but Marconi Builders, and they were building homes in the White Hills price range.
He was in Florida.
Florida. That was around the area where Tarpon Springs and that vicinity. And they were building homes in the area of $150,000, $200,000. So I went to Florida that 1 year, specifically to see him, and he showed me the houses, and boy, they were a custom-made, beautiful, beautiful home. Mm-hmm. 1 year with them, and they made him construction superintendent.
Wow.
And the funny thing, how things fall in place, they were building a home for an executive of Levi Strauss in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And my son became acquainted with him and played golf with him. The guy was married, had a couple of children, and they got to be friends. One day this fellow asked him, he said, did you ever think about going into sales? Well, he thought about it, and he said, well, maybe so. So he called me at home. He says, what do you think about it? I said, well, why don't you keep bugging him? And he did. I'll never forget, Thanksgiving came, and he got a call to go to New York City, Levi headquarters. And he had three interviews that day. And my wife and I went there, and my daughter came down from Cornell. So we had a week there in New York. Well, the typical thing, I said, well, how'd it go? His boy, it was rough. I said, what you should do now is sit down and write thank you letters to all three of those individuals. He said, that's a good idea. So my daughter got a typewriter from down the hotel, typed three letters, mailed them. Of course, when he through the interviews, they told me, we'll call you.
Don't call us, we'll call you.
Right. Anyway, this was Thanksgiving time, so it was in November, December, and he kept, because I said, don't get anxious, something's going to happen. He said, well, maybe you should call one of those. He didn't. He didn't give any encouragement. But it was the first week in January, he got a call to report to Atlanta, Georgia for sales training.
Wow.
And I don't remember. That's right. He was there for 2 weeks. And then they assigned him to North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for some time. They moved to South Carolina. Then they moved him to Springfield, Missouri. He was there 5 years. And God, he makes five or six times what I used to make.
Yeah.
God, my top money. And now he's been transferred to Nashville, Tennessee. He got a promotion and doing real fine.
I guess he didn't end up in Jackson Prison.
Pardon?
I guess he didn't end up in Jackson Prison.
But I can't believe that they have so... Levi Strauss treats their people real well. Mm-hmm. He's been with them 10 years. And he's got a investment fund that's worth $500,000.
Wow.
And they have more activities going on. Sales meetings in San Francisco, New Orleans, New York City, you name it. God, it seems like Thomas says, you have more damn vacation than you work.
You mentioned something that made me kind of think of something else I wanted to ask you. We're talking about racism. Do you remember when you worked at the Rio, were there any... Did you have mixed ethnic groups working there, and did you have any problems?
No, not at all. In fact, we didn't have an awful lot of black people. We had some Hispanics. And I remember the two. I became acquainted with two black guys. One of them was worked for the maintenance department. And he was a cement mason, and the another guy was the sweeper. They were just both great guys.
Mm-hmm.
Funny, good, always good stories.
And they were treated well there.
Oh, were treated well, absolutely.
They were the old timers. They'd been there for a while.
Yes, they had been.
Yeah.
In fact, that fellow was a cement mason. God, I think he'd been there from like 25 years.
Mm. Oh.
So they'd been there a long, long time. Very, 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 very good workers.
Mm-hmm. We asked Louis this question, and he said, oh, no problems.
No.
If anybody had a problem, it was their problem, not my problem.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That
well, one thing about Louis, though, everybody liked him.
Yeah.
That's one. He's just a nice guy.
Yeah, he's got quite a personality.
Yeah, a real personality. Used to kid him a lot. He was always comes back with a good reply.
Yeah.
But I see a common thread running through you fellows from supervisors. You all are aggressive, and you're assertive, and you're smart, and you know how to, and you don't mind working.
Right.
And I think that's maybe what lifted you guys from the production line.
I think that's
because you wanted to get ahead. And it used to be able to go into a shop or a place and work and get ahead, didn't it?
You remember that period of time when the quota thing came up? I remember I had my office on the main floor back then. I had two white gals and two follow-up men working for me, and I had another gal, so I sent a requisition in for help. My boss approved it, went to personnel. Lo and behold, I got a black gal. She said it was a mistake.
Mm. Was this because of the government contracts you had to have?
Yes,
affirmative action?
Yes. She's what a situation I run into.
Hmm.
She was single mother.
Oh, single parent.
As a rule, Monday morning the phone would ring, can't come in, babysitter isn't here, her baby's sick. Or she'd go home on Fridays early.
Hmm.
God, it was more absentee than it was work time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned, we hired her as a file clerk. She could not file alphabetically or numerically. God, and I kept Alex. Well, I said, we got to get rid of that girl. I said, well, I'd rather have nobody than have her, because she follows things up so bad.
Yeah.
And we had an awful... He said, you're going to have problems. I said, I don't give a damn. I don't want her anymore. She just causes us troubles.
The clerical staff wasn't union. Were they? Was the clerical staff union?
I don't think so either.
No, but you just had... The personnel department had
to
have some in because of the government.
Right.
Yeah.
But finally we got rid of her.
Mm-hmm.
Another incident that brings back bad thoughts was that we hired a fellow in the department that I had worked at one time, accounts payable, as an auditor. He was a minister too.
Mm.
And the sexual harassment thing came up.
Oh.
And I know these girls well enough they wouldn't be telling stories. He said they... Girls told me that we had a file room at the back, way at the back, for our invoice and a purchase order records, accounts payable did. The hell, a gal didn't dare go there by herself if he was there.
Oh, no.
Or if she did go, he'd follow her in there.
Oh.
And then this Ed Bronkman had a heck of a hard time getting rid of him, too. Same reason.
So she had recourse. She had a place to go when this was happening. She had someone she could talk, tell this to, and some action would be taken.
Well, she talked to her supervisor, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was about as far as it went.
Yeah.
And he in turn complained to the personnel department that they've got the same story. You're going to have troubles. Mm-hmm. Well, God, if this is what's happening, we don't want that kind of people.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty recent, though. That was already, the company
yes.
wasn't going to last much longer beyond
right,
that.
Right, exactly. It was on its tail end.
70s already.
Right.
60s.
So I suppose the people at the very top didn't care all that much because, you know, about solving problems because they knew they weren't going to be there.
That's right. And was near.
Yeah. And so they fired you. Mildred gave you your papers?
Yes. Yeah. God, that was a really shocker.
It's horrible. That's a horrible thing.
And you know, the thing that I think was most embarrassing was the fact, too, that I being in capacity where I was, I had a parking place back of the office building down below, not in the garage, but at least a handy parking place. God, I never forget, we had to take our personal things, put them in the box. And then they had plant protection there, they had to go through and see they weren't stealing anything.
Oh.
Well,
that really rubbed them.
After so many years.
Yeah,
so demeaning.
Who'd want anything that wasn't?
Yeah.
But it was just another way to humiliate you almost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had a black fellow there, that Otis, who was, he was more or less the messenger. He washed cars, he'd done errands for the brass. And talk about a real nice guy. I don't think, and we all liked him. Otis Dumas, I never forget him.
Otis what?
Otis Dumas, D-U-M-A-S.
Oh, okay. Did he come to give you your message then?
No. No, I said that when I got my slips, I just had no. Was told just to leave.
Yeah.
So right then, right now.
Right then,
today.
Right now, yeah. In fact, did Louis mention anything about, God, I can't remember the guy's name, Clubhouse?
Oh, yeah, he did.
He did, the manager of the clubhouse?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Vern Haight.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
Vern Haight. I never forget that. He was down, he was in the garage at the time. I guess he was getting Hanson's car ready to go someplace. And he saw me come in. He said, "What happened?"
Mm.
I told him. God, he had tears in his eyes. I forget that.
Oh.
He said, it shouldn't be.
No.
Must be a lot of you supervisors were let go.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there was 37 of us in this group that filed class action suit against Diamond Rio.
Oh, you did after you were fired?
Right. And then we in turn, when Diamond Rio went bankrupt, we transferred the suit to White Motors.
Oh.
That's when they went bankrupt. And we were suing for severance pay, payment of our hospitalization, sickness insurance,
mm-hmm.
and pension, of
pensions,
course.
Right.
And mm-hmm. we had, Bill McKay was the attorney, and we met with him regularly. And I never forget the last time we met with him, he said, "Tell us it's all done."
Oh.
And he took it on a contingency basis, too,
yeah.
So
yeah.
He didn't get anything out of all the
books. Unless you guys won something.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you never got anything from
no,
him?
No.
Never?
In fact, one of the guys, I never forget, is Dan Littlefield. He had like a hundred and some thousand dollars coming. No way.
We had a volunteer here at the museum for a time, and her husband was one of the people. He wasn't supervisor, he was production, I think. I don't recall his position, but he was never able to do anything with his life again after the breakup. It just absolutely disintegrated him as a person. He just said.
Yeah, the thing that The thing I think that's puzzling is this, that she selected people which were, without them there, would destroy an organization.
Yeah.
You know, you're head of the engineering, head of the paint department, head of the assembly department, head of master mechanics department, just all those categories.
You can see the planning, can't you?
Yeah, well, they're trying to dismantle it, I bet.
See how this is happening.
Yeah.
Right.
My goodness.
Well,
it's a wonder she got out of Lansing alive. Did she go to Mississippi too, do you think?
I don't know.
It's just a wonder someone didn't run into her car or something. There must have been some threats.
You know, I don't know, probably Louis told us, but Capper really feared for his life. Because.
Well, was that right?
Yeah, because it had been said that some of the hourly people were determined to kill him.
Mm. So did he have bodyguards, or?
I think so. It was a really, because you can imagine this, some of these, you know, these hourly employees got held. Some got 40 years in there. They were let go.
Yeah,
I think this is the husband's that I was just telling you about. I think that was his situation, and he got a tiny percentage eventually of his pension. I don't know, 2% or something.
Well, see, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Association gives us a little money each month.
That's probably.
But it's very that's probably what he's getting. It's very insignificant. I think that most of the people that were let go at that particular time, and that's 37 or more, whatever there was, they were all in the category where they would be drawing 700 plus retirement per month. So that was quite a blow to find out that one day you're going to have, the next day you don't have nothing.
And it's too late in life to get another job anywhere else, and you could never have enough time to build another.
And see, the thing is that to be let out of a job at 50 years old or older, it's pretty difficult to get a job anymore, because the people out there think about hiring you, they're thinking, well, I've got to pay this fellow pension eventually. So it's 15 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that wasn't.
I wonder if Mildred Johnson had fears for her safety too, and if she had a bodyguard.
I wonder that too.
Because if she's the one that's the hatchet person,
she
would be
that's,
the focus
the
of
name.
The hate, wouldn't she?
Yeah.
Right.
I know this woman that I was speaking of said her husband was, and she both, to this day, very bitter.
She's
very bitter. And he died. She said she, and almost as what you said earlier about a person almost dying, almost you could say were murdered because of it.
Yeah, that's just shattered their life.
Mm-hmm. And he was never able to pull himself together, and he died. And she said she knows that he would be alive today if it hadn't been for the stress on his body because of it.
That's unfortunate, truly unfortunate.
It's a sad ending for a place that had such promise and such family and such.
Oh yes, that's right.
Capability of production.
That's right.
Yeah, because Glenn was the one who talked about how he believed the quality of the things produced there was so superior.
Oh God, they were.
Who
was this, you think?
Glenn Green.
Oh, Glenn Green, oh yeah.
Yeah, he went on and on about that.
Oh yeah, super quality.
And how the plant would make things to order for people, special orders.
Right.
For specific needs.
Custom made,
right.
Right.
Which is very rare.
Very conscientious.
Yeah. Even at that time, pretty rare to find something like that. I just have a couple more questions about your own, personal situation. You said you mentioned only once when you were talking about being drafted at 29 that you were married and you had a
child there.
Right.
Yeah.
So you met your wife earlier than that?
Right.
You didn't meet her through Olds or Rio or
No, I don't remember, no. She worked at Walgreens downtown.
Oh, she worked at Walgreens.
Right, I used to go there quite a lot.
Walgreens, right.
Right.
And you had two children and a little
girl? I have four.
Four, okay.
Right.
You mentioned a girl and then you mentioned your son.
I had a girl and I have three daughters and a one son.
Okay.
And the The oldest lives in Linden, Michigan. Okay. She's married to... Now, there's again a something that... I don't know whether you want to hear this kind of story or not. But, when she was 15 years old, she was going to... She met a guy that I didn't particularly like. My wife thought it was all right. Something, for some reason, it just didn't. She ran away at 15 and got married.
Oh.
Of course, he, when they came back up here, and within a year, she had a baby. But in that time, they moved from place to place to place, God. And he didn't work.
Mm.
And well, I got a call one day from Naps. He said, I got an invoice from Naps, several hundred dollars. I know I've been down there for a long time. I went down there and I said, I don't owe you this money. What is this? He had forged my name and bought Christmas presents, 200 and some dollars worth. I got an invoice from Richmond Brothers downtown. Same thing. Went down and talked to him. That wasn't my signature. I didn't pay either. But this never changed a great deal. And we were at wit's end what to do. We didn't particularly want her at home. And yet, we had a good talk with him one day. He said, if you'll go back to school, leave this bum, which he was, really, damn, no good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll pay your rent, and babysitting, care of everything else. So she got her, and this is how things work out. By God, the things do work out at times. She got a...
Well, if you have people who care about you, you know.
Right.
She
finished school, living in the same apartment. And one day, she says to me, she said, I'm going with somebody, I'd like to have him meet him. God, I couldn't believe it. He's the guy who was on the first window at the bank where I banked.
Oh.
He's a nice guy, and I thought, I told my wife, I said, that'd be the kind of guy that Jackie ought to marry me. God, they got married.
Isn't that funny how life happens?
Yeah, just a real nice guy.
And he adopted the girl.
He adopted
the kid.
Girl.
The child, yeah.
And she turned out to be a problem, too. She turned out to be a problem, the my granddaughter.
Probably inherited some
trait. Yeah, well, that was sure it is, because, believe it or not, by the way, backing up a minute, this Dave Lincoln, who his oldest daughter married, he ended up in Jackson Prison.
He ended up in
Jackson. Yeah. Then he was out riding someplace after he got out, and he was killed in an accident. That was
a wasted life.
Yeah.
Just a wasted life.
I feel bad for his daughter.
Yeah.
So she's got all these things probably in her system.
Well, I have a daughter living in San Francisco. She's unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
She's a teacher at junior college. She graduated with her master's out here at MSU and went to Kansas State University, to work on her PhD and teach at the same time. First she taught at Oklahoma State University, that's why Oklahoma University first, and then she went to Kansas to get her doctorate. Well, I don't know what happened, but there were 10 people applying for their doctorate. 8 men and 2 guys, 2 women. The men all got them, the women didn't. I said, why don't you sue them? Her grades were higher.
Yeah.
Other gals were too. I think that was a...
That was a lot.
Yeah, well, she went to... then she moved and went to San Francisco, teaching school there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of embittered her too.
Yeah.
And then the next is my son, who lives in... He's married, no children. His wife runs a business called Interior Scapes. which puts live plants in hotels, motels, banks, commercial buildings, and maintains them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's a sales rep for Levi Strauss. And then the youngest daughter, she got a scholarship at Cornell and a master's degree in environmental sociology. And she lives in Seattle, Washington. She's married, no children. And she works for the Puget
Sound
Water Authority.
That's where I went to Cornell.
Well, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, we went to visit her one time. It was a
beautiful,
nice school.
Isn't it?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Up on that hill. Beautiful sight to see coming into.
Yeah.
What's the name of that town?
Ithaca.
Ithaca, New York, right.
Just like Ithaca, Michigan.
Right.
And there's a Lansing, New York, too.
Yes, there is.
Because there are a lot of the same people. Went from there to here.
Remember the hills of Ithaca.
Yeah. Did she enjoy that?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, she got a good scholarship.
Yeah.
So that helped.
Sure.
Your children are the first people in your family to go on to college then.
Right, right.
You and your brother were the only ones out of your family.
Right.
What
they have one son. And he lives in Tucson, Arizona. And this son has three children.
Did your brother work in the shop too, at the factory?
My brother, no. He, I'm trying to think. When he got out of school, he didn't go any further, I don't think, than Eastern. He went to work for Clark Ackley as an architectural apprentice.
Oh.
So he was an architectural draftsman all those years.
That's nice.
Oh,
right. He worked for many firms. Well, the last one of which he retired from was Warren Holmes Company on North Washington.
And you said your parents lived in Lansing, and their parents too before them. So the whole from way back, your family.
Now let me just
Lansing?
Take a second. No, my mother and father both came from Germany.
Oh, they came from Germany.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And they weren't acquainted in Germany. They met here, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of lost contact, but I know that they both had relatives back in Germany.
Mm-hmm. And this is your parents, your mother and father? So you're first, so you're second generation. They're first generation?
Correct.
Oh, okay. And how did they end up here? Do you know how they ended up in Lansing?
If I remember right, at the time somebody had to be responsible for
them. Right.
There was Hauers, Hauer, East Lansing had that market. Well, just beyond the boulevard.
Uh-huh.
That's I think Quality Dairy back in there now.
Okay. But
they had a food market, and apparently my mother knew
that person.
Knew them personally when they were in Germany.
Germany.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
My father.
Did they come here before World War I?
No, let's see.
If you were born in 1915.
They must have.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
They must
because
have.
That's
they came before the war.
Right.
She must have been very young when she came.
She must have been. I think my dad had my father had two sisters who came over later. So I got to know them.
Mm.
I knew them.
It's a lot of discrimination against German people during World War I. It was terrible.
There was World War II, too.
Yeah.
Yes,
it was almost
right.
Even worse than World War I.
In fact, this is an interesting point, too. I remember when I went into the service that there was thought of going into they had suggested that my commanding officer told me about it later that I would be maybe going to CIA, but I was German, and they were afraid that I would have other.
Oh, you'd have relatives, and you'd be
sick.
Oh,
Oh,
just
sure.
Kind of remote, you know.
And yet they would take people like that that had relatives in Germany and put them in G2 intelligence because they would be able then to have contacts and talk to these people. So it can go both ways, can't
well,
it?
Did your parents speak German at home?
Right, and of course.
And you learned German too?
Right. I can speak some. I've forgotten a great deal, but I this was helpful to me in World War II because I was what they call a spare parts clerk for an engineer maintenance company, and I was always there for interpretation. This was great. I'll never forget that several times it wasn't too pleasant thing to have to do.
Yeah.
But
really?
Yet, I remember to a couple of incidents. We were at Nuremberg, and Lieutenant Wers, who was our platoon commander, said, "Artie," said, "we have to go downtown. I need you to interpret." So we went to haul things to a brewery, and he wanted me to make arrangements to have beer shipped to our area every week.
Oh, and my dad has stories like this too. My dad was over there too. His stories are about schnapps, not beer.
Yeah, schnapps. Anyway, so we went there, and of course they gave us a treat and told them what we wanted and. Fine, I made arrangements financially for it. Then we went to an ice house and made arrangements for ice at the same time. And we got one of those big horse watering tanks, put the beer in there.
A trough.
And put the beer and the ice in there.
Amazing there was a horse trough left in Germany after the war. We have a volunteer from here who was in Germany at the end of the war and just after, and he talked about the total destruction and trying to find anything that was in one piece to do something with. So
you know, the there were times too when we didn't do this intentionally, I don't think, but one day I remember that we were sleeping out in the woods, and it was like November, cold. God, it was cold in Belgium.
Oh.
And we had all we were asleep with our clothes on and blankets and whatever it could. We still were freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And the commanding officer came back, called a formation. He said, "This is the last time we're going to sleep in the woods." We wondered why, and he said, "I just came from Army headquarters, and those birds are all living in German residents."
Oh.
He said, "We're going to do it from now on."
Mm-hmm.
And I never forget, I was always the goat then. They'd take me along, and I never forget, I went to this big, beautiful home in Landshut, Germany. On the property was an electrical parts manufacturing plant, big plant.
Oh,
garages and everything else under the sun. And my commanding officer said, "I want you and I going to go in the office and talk to these people." He said, "I want you to tell him that he has 4 hours to get his stuff out of that house. We're moving in."
Oh, wow.
That isn't funny. You know, the guy's face just turned red, brilliant red.
That's what Aftang Army is all about.
Right.
and you had to tell him.
He said something to me in German, which I understood. And objected, of course, very vigorously, and he wasn't very nice about it either. He could have used a little bit better judgment too.
Yeah.
But I told him, and after what he said, he said, "You just spoiled this." Yes, he's got 1 hour to get out now.
Oh, Lord! Did you know where your parents came from in Germany?
Well, my father came from the Eastern Zone, Leipzig. My mother, I do not know.
Because I was just wondering if when you were back there, you wanted to.
Well, I wanted to go, but it just wasn't possible.
You weren't in the area.
You didn't have control.
You mentioned you were in Belgium. Were you there?
Yeah, we were France. We were England and France, and then Belgium, and then Germany, and then back to France, and then back to the Pacific.
My goodness, you really suck. Oh, you went to the Pacific.
Yeah.
Oh, you really saw
correctly,
that. Didn't
we went.
You?
Oh boy, that was talking about a sickening bunch of low morale people.
Yeah. To know that you couldn't go home and you had to go on to the.
Yeah, we went from Germany to Marseille, France, up in the mountains for redeployment, retooling for Pacific. See, we had 185 men and 6 officers and a lot of mobile equipment because we were an engineering company, shop trucks and repair outfits, wreckers, and so forth.
Mm.
So we were up in the mountains there getting ready to ship to, to the Philippines. Boy, that was sad, because the day we went on board ship, everything went on board ship, and we went through the Panama Canal, so close to home and yet so far, and went to the Philippine Islands. We weren't there too long, but it was just, still, we were there from, I got, some of us, I had enough points in December to get out. We got there in July, so that was five months. That was the longest. I keep telling that we have as much sea time as a lot of sailors did. We were 37 days on board that ship, and it was 17,000 some miles.
Miles.
Ooh,
that'd be long.
That's a long
trip.
I guess I was thinking, when you said Belgium, I was thinking the Battle of the Bulge, close to the end of the war and all of
well,
that.
No, along the way, we made friends, of course, too, with the people. And in England, another fellow I became real close friends of a family called Victor and Ethel Corderay, who owned the Jolly Waterman pub. Real nice family. They had, I think, one daughter. Yeah, one daughter and a son. And they used to invite us.
Yeah, we should go. So, look ahead. We're keeping you around.
No, I want to hear this.
They used to invite us for dinner, go to church with them, and he'd always do little special things for us. And we kept in contact with him for years. 25 years later, to the date almost, my wife and I and one daughter went to Europe.
Wonderful.
Great.
And we went to England, and we went to their home, and we went to the tavern, and it was saw
it was still there.
Pardon?
The tavern.
Oh
was
yeah,
still
it was still there. And I said, "Where's your wife? Where's Ethel? She's working downtown at this department store." He said, "She's sell books." So we went down to this department store, and she didn't recognize me at all.
Oh.
And my sister, I said, "We're looking for some Mickey Mouse comics." She looked kind of weird at me, you know. Mickey Mouse comics. I said, "You don't know who this is, do you? Art Fromm. Oh my God, you know." Since you know.
What a reunion.
Yeah, what a reunion. Oh. Then from there, we went to Belgium, which I had. This is a kind of an incident too. Back when we were in the service, we moved all the time. And winter day, open trucks, you know, the canvas, but that don't keep you warm.
No.
And we stopped at this little town for like a lunch break. And when we were out of the truck, this was by this one building, and this man said, "We'd like to come in where it's warm." So he and another fellow, I went inside. And his mother was there, and she made a great big bowl of homemade soup.
Mm.
We had homemade soup and nice homemade bread.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a Dr. Martin, and he was a veterinarian. And they had three children about the same ages as ours. And I'll never forget, he went back into the, way in the back someplace, and he'd come out with a dusty bottle of cognac and give us each a drink of cognac.
Mm.
He'd hide it from the Germans. Years later, when we were on this run, we went to his home. Of course, he'd prospered real well. He had a big, beautiful brick home.
Mm.
We stayed with them, I think, for 2-3 days. And he couldn't speak much English, and I couldn't speak any French. So they got, in that town there, there's a monastery that was founded the year 900 A.D. And they got a couple of priests, one from London and one from Boston.
Oh, so they could translate.
Yeah. And they came over to translate.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the priest invited us back. We toured that monastery. It was quite an experience.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. Yeah. It must have been.
And then back again later, one day we were in Lansing, got a phone ring, and said, "This is Father Gerard." God,
yeah.
That's the priest from Boston.
Oh.
He says, I'm in Lansing. I'm at the Greyhound bus station. I'd like to see you. He said, "I got a schedule tomorrow to preach at the St. Gerard Church.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So we picked him up and brought him home to our house, and we went to church service Sunday, too, of course.
Sure.
That was interesting.
Reunion.
Reunion again.
Oh, how wonderful.
That's funny because my dad did the same thing with our family, too.
Really?
He took us back to all the places.
And then there's Belgium.
Oh, you've been able to... Oh,
yeah.
I'd die to do that.
In Belgium... In Belgium, we were there in a snow time, just like, you know, deep snow, cold. And we were billeted in private homes there, because there was no place for set up anything else. And people were real gracious about it, too.
Were they? They probably didn't have much.
No, Bellefontaine was the place, and it probably was about the size of Hope.
Small village.
Yeah. And we call the Mama and Papa Lasseron. He could speak German and French, so I could talk to him in German. He could refer to his wife
In French.
And, you know, they were just wonderful people, because
they were happy to see you, too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Happy to see the Americans.
And,
I would think.
Yeah.
She always said to us, when you get your food at night, whatever, bring it back to the house to get it where it's warm, because we had to stand out there in the hallway to light. And we'd always bring extra bread, because we got good bread.
And you could share that with
me. And one day, I met the baker.
Mm.
And met some other people in the town, too. And one day she says to me, tomorrow we're going to have something special. Okay. So we brought our meal back there, and she had made French fried potatoes. Baked rabbit.
Oh, my.
God, what a delicacy.
We're not talking sea rations here,
right? And, you know, then the... I don't know how it happened, but one day I was talking to him. I said, what would it take to have the baker bake an apple pie? So he went over and saw him. And he said, well, he said, if you get us some shortening and some apples, we'll go ahead and... God, he baked a pie.
Ooh.
Huge.
Ooh.
We shared it, of course, with the guys, too. But when we came back to that reunion,
yeah.
When we got, you know, when we, it's funny to say, 25 years have elapsed. I had a car. I rented a car. I'm driving up this thing. I knew exactly where to turn.
Yeah.
Oh.
It hadn't changed that much.
Oh.
And we got down the street, and they knew we were coming, of course. We had written beforehand, but I didn't know exactly when. And we can see the doors opening up. The Americans are here.
Oh, great.
And isn't that wonderful?
We got in the house, and the phone rang, and it was the baker.
Said, I'm going to make you another pie.
Right.
How wonderful.
Every place you went, they wanted to give you something to eat, something to drink, too.
They remembered that's the way it was.
Oh, yeah.
Had they been occupied by the Germans before you guys came?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In that little village?
Yeah.
My dad was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Was he? I'm going to talk to you about that sometime.
Yeah, he was. Well, he was much younger than you. He was 19.
Well, he was.
Yeah, when he went over.